Hello and welcome to the National Trust podcast. I'm Claire Hickinbotham. This week we're bringing you a family history story about the craftsmen of Cork Abbey. It's an episode from a podcast we think you'll really like, Step Into the Past, by Find My Past, our sponsors of this whole episode. In this story, Professor Susanna Lipscomb and her guest Sandy travel to the not-so-stately home of Cork Abbey in Derbyshire to discover Sandy's long-standing connection to the estate, the skilled workers who honed their crafts over generations, and fostered an unusually close relationship with their wealthy patrons.
Hello and welcome back to Step Into the Past, the podcast where we take you back in time to follow in the footsteps of our ancestors, brought to you by Find My Past. In each episode, we'll explore the stories of historical lives and their connections to places right across the UK. And we speak to their descendants to discover the impact of their legacy today. I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, historian, author, and TV presenter. I'm particularly fascinated by the stories of people from the past and how they experience the world. I particularly enjoy solving the poignant puzzles of family history and how these can be pieced together using historical records and other clues from the past. We'll be doing lots of that in this episode. In today's episode, we've come to Cork Abbey near Ticknor in Derbyshire to discover a family story that is closely associated with this estate. Throughout its extensive history, Cork Abbey has experienced a series of remarkable transformations. From religious priory to grand stately home, it has remained at the heart of the community in all its guises for hundreds of years. Our tale spans almost two centuries, during which time members of the family we're exploring were moving around, but time and time again, they found themselves drawn back to the patronage, community and refuge offered by Cork Abbey. Over generations, they honed their craft and were rewarded for their expertise and dedication by their wealthy patrons. Keep listening as we discover what life would have been like for a skilled rural working class living in these beautiful Derbyshire surroundings and how one estate was integral to a community for generations. Let's meet today's guest, Sandy. I'm very pleased to be joined by you here in the stable courtyard, now a restaurant at Cork Abbey. Welcome.
Thank you. Really pleased to be here.
Your family is a wonderful example of a family who lived and worked in dedicated service to Cork Abbey. And in return, as we'll see, enjoyed the stability and security that that connection could offer. Do you know much about your family history at this sprawling and now unstately home?
I actually didn't know any of this history. So as far as I knew, my dad's mum, my grandma, was from Manchester. And it wasn't until I started looking into family history during COVID that I discovered through one of my aunties that she knew some of the history of the family being from Cork, but if she hadn't told me, I wouldn't have known.
Fantastic. So we've got some things that are new for you today. Yeah. Okay, well, we've started here at the stables for a reason, because we're going to talk about your five times great grandparents, Francis Peace and Jane Hill. So I want you to have a look at the sires of this stable complex, because that's going to become part of the story. So Francis Peace, your five times great-grandfather, at the age of 36, we have him in 1811, working as an undergroom and then a groom, and earning £25 a year, which translates to £2,750 a year in today's money.
Gosh.
Which isn't much. But I think it tells us that he has, as we'll see from later evidence, everything provided for him. So accommodation is provided, probably food is provided. So it's kind of almost a bonus salary on the side. So let's have a little walk and we'll see some of the areas in which he worked.
Lovely, thanks.
Um, Are you equestrian at all?
You know, I used to be. And it's through the auntie who told me the history of the family that she was a horsewoman. And
how interesting.
And so I always loved horses and had a pony up until I left home, really, in my teenage years. So, yeah, we've always had a strong horsey background.
Isn't that amazing? I love the fact that you've got that, you know, horsey tradition, as it were, going down through your family.
Well, it looks like it's come from somewhere now.
It does, doesn't it? Absolutely. So here we are in the stables, in which Frances would have worked. It's amazing, isn't it, to see them?
It's fantastic. Beautiful.
They are beautiful. And also, you get a sense of how many horses there would have been.
Yes.
So we know that Frances was responsible for their everyday welfare. Mm-hmm. So making sure they were in peak condition all the time, treating their ailments, delivering foals, collecting, delivering horses when they were being bought and sold. And this estate has a lot of horses. This is a big sort of industry for it.
Oh, right.
And delivering post horses on long carriage journeys. And one fun thing is that in the steward's accounts, we have the travel expenses for journeys.
Really?
Tolls paid.
Oh, gosh.
Payments for board and horseshoes. So he was traveling a lot. And two things, I guess, to note. One is, this is a highly specialised job. Mm. It's hard work as well. He's up early, he's to bed late, and he's a really highly trusted servant because a horse was a major financial expense. So if you had a hack or a functional cob, it could cost something like £25 to £40. So Francis's yearly salary, whereas if you're talking about a fine carriage horse, that was something like £100.
Yes.
So, I mean, all this depends on the horse's age and health and that sort of thing. But the point is, this is something you only put in the hands of someone you trust.
Mm.
And how interesting that you, too, have a history of being equestrian.
And had that interest, from my auntie.
I find that so interesting, about thinking about what comes from genetics.
It's carried down through the generations,
So, Frances married Jane, mm-hmm. as you know, but Jane died in 1824 when she was only 46. And this gives us another interesting clue, because she was buried at Melbourne Baptist Chapel.
Is that very far away?
It's quite near. It's quite nearby, only a few miles away. But it might suggest that she was from there.
Mm-hmm.
We're not quite sure when Ticknell Baptist Chapel was established, so it might have been that there wasn't one here at that time, but other evidence suggests it might have been here already.
Mm.
So maybe that's where she comes from. It's about 4 miles away. But it also shows that she's Baptist. And that in itself is interesting. I'll come back to that because that's an interesting part of your family history.
Uh-huh.
And after Jane's death, Francis remained here at his post for about 30 years. And so we find him in 1841. After all his daughters have left home, including your four times great-grandmother Mary, living here. He lives in the stable block.
Gosh.
He's still here in 1851 when he's 75.
Mm-hmm.
He's 75. He's still working as a groom.
Wow. He must have really been a strong man.
He must have been a strong man.
Strong and physically strong.
Absolutely. And that's quite a long life in the mid-19th century, isn't it?
It is.
And one thing that's really interesting is you can see how much he was loved and respected by his employers. Because towards the end of his life, there were entries in the steward's accounts that show that Sir John, Harper Crewe, continued to pay wages to Francis when he was 77, and it seems quite ill. So he probably wasn't working by that point, and continued to pay those for another 3 years.
Gosh.
And also was paying a schoolmistress from the nearby village called Sarah Marshall to attend to him. So I think we might say she was a carer.
That's amazing. So you get that support from the family.
It is, isn't it? Being looked after in old age, well before the welfare system.
Yeah. So a trusted retainer, kind of.
Exactly, a trusted retainer.
We'll see some more about that at our next stop.
Great. Can't wait.
On my mum's side, we always knew that there had been servants in big houses in Cumbria, but we had no idea about this side with servants here.
So interesting. So you come on both sides of your family from kind of generations of trusted retainers.
It would seem so.
Reliable stock.
Reliable stock. Behind the scenes.
Behind the scenes, yes.
Which is what my job was, yeah.
How interesting, of course. As a stage manager, you were the reliable person behind the scenes.
That's right. Melting into the background.
I think that's fascinating. That's a fascinating parallel.
It is, isn't it? I hadn't thought of it until now. It's just, it's a different thing. You know, we say, or we used to say, you know, we're the butlers to the industry.
Yeah. But it takes a certain sort of person to live a life of service beyond the public gaze and to be trustworthy in that way. Like I don't think we're extrapolating too much to say, you know, you have to be a person of some character.
Yes.
To be able to do those things.
Yes. Yeah. I think you're right.
And as we shall see when we get up to the church, your ancestor Francis was very much one of those people.
I can't wait to see what you're going to show me.
Right, so we're just coming up to St. Giles Church, where we can pick up the story of Francis. He was maintained for those last 3 years or so of his life, and he dies at 80 years old. It's the 26th of January, 1855.
It's a good age.
It's a really good age in 1855.
Yeah.
And his death was reported a few days later in the Derby Mercury.
Really?
And I've got what it says. It says, at Cork Abbey, on Friday evening, the 26th, highly and most deservedly respected, Francis Peace, in the 80th year of his age, and groom to Sir J.H. Crewe, Baronet, and faithful servant to the family for three generations.
Oh.
Isn't that nice?
That's amazing.
And here he is.
Francis Peace, who departed this life at Cork Abbey, January 26, 1855, in his 80th year. A stone is erected by Sir John Harper Crewe, Baronet, in grateful remembrance of the long and valuable services of an old and faithful servant of his family for three generations. Oh, that's amazing. He really was held in high esteem, wasn't he?
He really was.
Yeah, fantastic. Gosh, I had no idea.
I mean, this is a very impressive headstone. It would have been expensive.
Yes.
It's of such a stone that we can still read it.
I know, that's amazing in itself, isn't it?
So it's a high quality stone.
Yeah.
And we've got these various indications in the newspaper. Most deservedly respected, highly and most deservedly respected, a faithful servant for the family for three generations. Here, long and valuable services, grateful remembrance of an old and faithful servant.
It's really amazing. It really is. I mean, that just shows how highly they thought of him.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And one thing that's quite interesting about this is that, of course, his wife, Jane, was buried at Melbourne Baptist Church.
Right.
But if you look over here, Francis was buried next to the Harper Crewes.
Oh, wow. Yes.
So right next to the family plot.
So he's given a very privileged position.
Really privileged. Really privileged.
But it means he can't be buried with the rest of his family.
And I don't know if that says that he's Church of England and she's Baptist.
Oh. Okay.
I don't know. Or if it's just a decision that was made by the estate.
Yeah. I guess it was more important for him to be buried near the family, as far as they were concerned.
And again, it goes back to that sense of recognising his service.
Yeah.
A very beautiful, so peaceful place under this yew tree.
And he gets to stay on the estate forever.
He does.
Basically, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's lovely. Really lovely.
We do actually have another association with the Baptists.
Uh-huh.
So we're going to now follow the trail with your great-great-great-great-grandmother, Mary.
Oh, right.
Frances and Jane's daughter.
Right.
Let's go.
Fabulous.
Should we have a look in the church before we go?
Oh, I'd love to do that.
I mean, that's such a wonderful, tangible memorial to your ancestors.
It really is. That's truly amazing. The rest of the family are going to be so excited when they hear about that, because I don't think any of them have any idea of this either.
And here's one of those things. We were saying that the problem with family history is so often it's difficult to get at people's character.
Yeah.
But there you've got it.
Yeah.
Written in stone.
That's right.
Come and look over here.
This is the John, Sir John Harper Crewe, who created that memorial of your ancestor.
Wow.
But it says about him, in loving memory of Sir John Harper Crewe, 9th Baronet, born at Cork Abbey, November 18th, 1824. So he's only actually 31 when he does that amazing thing and puts that headstone up.
That is amazing.
Or 30 perhaps even. Married 20th of November, 1845. And interesting, it says here he was a steady friend, kind and considerate as a landlord, and generous and sympathising towards the poor.
Yes.
And we've already kind of got that impression of him, haven't we?
He does. He sounds like the best sort of landowner, doesn't he?
He does.
For the day.
If you're going to have that kind of stewardship, you need to demonstrate that kind of service.
And presumably people repaid him with loyalty because of that.
Exactly.
And so people must have just stayed here and worked here for generation after generation.
It's precisely that relationship that's the story between Sir John and Francis.
Yes.
One looking after the other, this kind of mutual bond. Ready to move on?
Yeah.
We're going to go to our second area. There is more.
Wow.
And actually, we're going to pick up the story with Francis and Jane's daughter, Mary, your direct ancestor, in Cork Abbey itself.
Oh, great.
So at some point, I wonder how old these trees are. They planted this avenue, didn't they, up to the church?
Yes, it does. It looks beautiful. And every Sunday, I guess, everybody walked up here.
Exactly.
Were the services for the estate workers as well?
Yes, they would have been. Yeah. Absolutely, yes.
In fact, they would have had to have
there, yes. Which, again, is interesting to think about if they were actually Baptists.
It's funny because we do have a history of nonconformism on that side of the family, because in Manchester they were Methodists.
That's interesting. Yeah, we're going to pick up
Are we?
Talk a bit about that.
If you're enjoying Step Into the Past, I think you might like the National Trust podcast. You can explore over 130 episodes featuring immersive tales of history, nature, and adventure.
You have to imagine it without the scaffolding. Some work being done by the Trust at the moment. I think to replace the windows, but out of beautiful Derbyshire stone with those columns at the front and the rusticated ground floor. It's all, you know, all the correct orders.
Oh, it's lovely, isn't it? Beautiful.
Okay, well, we're actually going to go inside the abbey.
Great.
You haven't been inside yet, have
no,
you?
No, no. This is... I'm just really looking forward to this.
Very exciting. So Julie here is going to take us upstairs. And we have some exclusive behind-the-scenes access where we're going to go to the stores.
Oh, fantastic.
I love it when you get to go behind the ropes.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Thanks, Julie.
Thank you.
Straight on up. Gosh, look at that light coming through.
Yeah.
Some amazing pictures.
I know.
And horses.
I know.
The horses that were being looked after.
The horses that were really important to the family.
Francis might well have looked after one of those.
Mm. And look at that one. That's all horses. That must be, is that on the estate?
Yes.
That's fabulous, isn't it?
There we go.
Ooh, gosh.
To the archive. So we're in the store, the archives.
Mm.
Look at the walls. You've got this amazing peeling
19th century wallpaper
covered in flowers.
Very beautiful.
It's very beautiful. Love the high ceilings as well.
Yeah.
So we're here to talk about your four times great grandmother, Mary, and her husband, Joseph, Joseph Radcliffe. So they married on the 22nd of July, 1824. She was 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He was 27. And that is the same year, of course, that her mother, Jane, died.
That's really difficult, isn't it? Had she already left home? Or was she?
She left home when she married. So as far as we can tell, I mean, that's the custom at this time.
Right.
So there's a transition there, a lot of transition. Now, Joseph's father was a farmer, but we first know about Joseph in the year before he married Mary. So he was a member of the Derbyshire Yeomanry Cavalry in the year before he married Mary. And we have a check stub for him, which shows that he was a trumpeter.
Wow.
In 1823-24. So we know that he was paid £23 for the year.
Gosh.
Have you ever played the trumpet?
No, I haven't. My grandma was a very good pianist. So okay. There is music on that side of the family as well.
Music and horses so
yeah,
far
we've music
found.
And horses, yeah.
Let me tell you about this. So we're looking at this amazing uniform of the Derbyshire Yeomanry Cavalry, which has got this glorious red waistcoat with gold buttons and gold braiding on, and then a black, sort of what we call a Nehru collar, with a red and gold collar, and again, gold buttons and epaulettes. It's really lovely, isn't it?
It's amazing.
So he would have worn this. Let me tell you about the Derbyshire Yeoman Cavalry. So it was formed in the late 18th century as a defence against the French, you know, at a time when war was on the horizon. And so it was mustered by the local gentry and paid for by them. And so Sir Henry Harper Crewe back then is the one who raised a troop of soldiers at Cork. So we don't know that this was his, but it gives you some size of what men at that time, doesn't it?
I know, he seems quite small, doesn't he?
Very small.
But I guess that was normal stature.
Exactly. And what I should say is that by the time that Joseph was part of the Yeomanry Cavalry, what they were really doing is acting as a kind of local police force.
Right.
So they were sort of dealing with local unrest or any troubles. So mm-hmm. I don't know if it was a voluntary position or not.
Right.
Or whether it was something one was recruited into.
Mm.
But obviously it's a really important part of the kind of the civic structure.
Yes. That's so interesting.
And this is the amazing thing. He commissioned a march to be played by the Derbyshire Yeomanry Cavalry from none other than the renowned Austrian composer Joseph Haydn.
No, really?
And so it's very, very likely that Haydn composed something that Joseph Radcliffe would have played.
Mm.
Actually, we can have a look at the march.
Oh, fantastic.
Look in this box. Very carefully. These are those wonderful, you know, acid-free boxes that keeps everything safe. Don't want it to touch the uniform. We just look inside here. We can see two marches composed by Joseph Haydn for Sir Henry Harper, Baronet, and presented by him to the volunteer.
Ah, it was a volunteer.
Cavalry of Derbyshire, embodied in the year 1794.
That's fascinating.
Isn't that right? And here we've got Lady Crewe, Cork Abbey, 94.
Mm.
The Honourable Lady Crewe. Isn't that brilliant?
It is.
Have a quick look at the meeting.
That's amazing.
How wonderful is that?
That's amazing. It really is. I used to play the clarinet many years ago at school.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, but I hated performing, which was why I gave it all up and went backstage instead.
Thank you. So let me tell you a bit more about Joseph. So after he was in the cavalry, the mm-hmm. volunteer cavalry, at some point after that, he had a career change. And we can find him in 1835 in Derby. And my guess is that's when he's an apprentice.
Oh.
So he trained as a shoemaker. And what we know is that he progressed and he became a very skilled craftsman. So in 1841, we can find that at his house, he's got two apprentices living with him, the same again in 1851. But really interestingly, by 1851, he's a master cordwainer.
Right.
And a cordwainer is a shoemaker who specializes in leather uh-huh. and in making shoes from scratch. So, I mean, shoemaking itself was a skilled profession, but cordwainers only worked in new leather, so that he's not a cobbler, he's not repairing right. shoes, he's making them from scratch.
Uh-huh. I didn't know that.
He was probably a member of the Cordwainers Guild. He probably had a workshop at his own house, which is where the apprentices are living with him in succession. And so he would have taken in commissions from people, both in the parish and in other parishes. And, you know, leather's durable, so it would have been used for agricultural workers' boots and fine boots as well.
Yes.
And they would have been an investment purchase for most people because a pair of boots would have cost a whole day's wage and they would have been lovingly repaired and kept.
Cared for, yes.
The other interesting thing is that it's quite a tricky time to be a shoemaker.
Mm. Why is that?
Because this is a sort of dying art.
Oh.
Because by the end of the 19th century, most of the shoemaking industry has been mechanized.
Right.
And so in actual fact, Joseph's son will go into shoemaking, but would have faced the challenges of, by the 1890s, coming up against, you know, the processes of industrialization that have made it possible to produce shoes much more cheaply. Anyway, so the apprenticeship system would have been a major part of Joseph's life. He would have been an apprentice. He then had apprentices, and we find him moving around the area a little bit. And he stayed in this career for the rest of his life.
Right.
So he's still a cordwainer in 1861 when he's 64. And then his son, also called Joseph, followed in his footsteps.
That's amazing.
And Mary and Joseph.
Mary and Joseph.
Had nine children.
Poor woman.
Absolutely. Those children were born between January 1826 and 1844. So she was pregnant over 19 years. I mean, not for yeah. all of the 19 years, obviously. But
every couple of years it yeah. was, really, wasn't it, in those days?
I mean, that's before you've got reliable contraception. That's yeah. how often women get pregnant.
Yeah.
A little bit of breastfeeding to keep them at bay, and that's about it. Anyway, so we've got Jane, Anne, Martha, Emma, Fanny, Charles, Joseph, Mary, and William.
Quite a brood.
And Jane is your great-great-grandmother.
Right. So the eldest.
The eldest. Mm. All the children's births were recorded at the Baptist chapel.
At the Baptist chapel, right.
So we're back to the Baptist faith again.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned earlier that you had some other nonconformists in your family.
Yes, my grandma's family from Manchester. They were all staunch Methodists, right down to my grandparents were staunch Methodists, and that came through from living in Manchester through the generations. From back from about the 1850s, I guess.
Well, it's really interesting because this is a time in which the Baptist faith is growing. We've got, I mean, it's founded in the 17th century, but it's only in 1816 that the General Baptist Missionary Society was founded to promote the faith. By 1817, there are something like 70 churches, especially in the Midlands area.
Right.
Especially because of the Industrial Revolution, we think.
Mm.
And fascinatingly, by 1851, half of the population of England and Wales are not going to the Church of England, but are going to nonconformist chapels.
I didn't know that.
And so I think that we can see several different things going on here. In part, it's print. You know, newspapers have really taken off at the end of the 18th century. News is spreading. In part, it's literacy now amongst those who are middle class, lower middle class, those sort of skilled workers like the Ratcliffes mm. would have been increasingly literate mm-hmm. and reading the Bible for themselves, for example. And there's also a kind of sense in which many of those who are nonconformists are thought to embody the virtues of temperance and frugality and prudence.
Temperance, yes, that was definitely part of it.
So I wonder if there's something about those being associated with artisans. But the final piece of the puzzle, I think, is the Industrial Revolution, because historians now think that this began sooner than people have previously thought, and that so from the early 1800s, Britain is industrialising, and that conditions for many of the workforce are just appalling. And this led to many turning away from what was perceived to be an exploitative establishment, and the established church is part of that.
Yes.
And there was definitely this idea that in the Church of England at the time, that if you were born into a certain station, you stayed there. And although we have exceptions like people like Sir John, I imagine that for many, those who were not of the gentry class actually found themselves more at home in something like the Baptist or the Methodist churches.
And I guess they found a sense of community, especially the family who migrated towards Manchester, because they're all strangers in a new place, but they're going there for work. And I guess the church and an alternative form of church was very much their social life as well.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. In fact, we have generations who that's how they met in Manchester, going to the same church.
There's also a sense of it being something inherited, because it looks like Mary's inheriting it from her mother. So Frances might be buried at the Church of England, but her mother's buried in a Baptist church.
Mm.
And then has your great-great-great-grandmother Jane baptised at the General Baptist Chapel in Ticknell. And this is what the baptism record reads.
Mm-hmm.
These are to certify that Jane Radcliffe, daughter of Joseph Radcliffe and of his wife, and of Mary, his wife, who was daughter of Francis and Jane Peace,
uh-huh,
was born in lawful wedlock in the parish of Ticknell in the county of Derby in the first day of January in the year 1826, at whose birth were present Anne Brooks, witness Thomas Hill, Sarah Hill, ex her mom. So the witness can't sign.
No.
Puts it, but John Brooks is the registrar.
Mm-hmm.
So Anne Brooks, his wife, has been brought out on the hills to witness this.
Well, do you think she was some sort of midwife as well?
Possibly. Mm. Possibly makes sense. That,
yeah.
I mean, that would be quite a good family industry, wouldn't it? One of you is a midwife and the other one's registrar. Producing work for each other.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. It really is.
And one final thing to say about the Baptist congregation is that they weren't necessarily welcomed. Anecdote for this. In 1827, there's an article that states that three men willfully and contemptuously disturbed and interrupted the congregation of General Baptist assembled at Ticknell.
Oh.
And this is just a year after Jane's baptism. So we can imagine that Mary and Joseph were present at the time.
So they were seen as scary, I guess, weren't they?
Disrupted.
As a threat.
Yes.
Yeah. Anti-establishment, maybe?
Yes. Do you think you are anti-establishment?
Well, maybe not. Yeah, I suppose so, yeah, in many ways. But we've grown up in a different time, haven't we? We've grown up with more freedom of thought.
Exactly.
And more freedom to travel and be educated in different ways and meet different cultures.
And it seems to me it's because people were anti-establishment then, because they were pressing back against that idea of how you should be, that we live in a freer time.
Yes, yes. For sure.
One last thing to tell you about Mary and Joseph's family. Well, at least by the 1851 census, Mary has died. And Joseph's a widower living in Ticknell with six children and one grandson. And there's a little bit of a scandal there. Well, scandalous by their standards, which is that the grandson, John, was the illegitimate child of the second daughter, Anne.
Uh-huh.
And she'd been a servant and had John when she was 17 years old in 1855. We don't know who the father was.
Right.
Obviously, it could be a local lad. I'd like to suggest that one situation in which lots of servant girls found themselves, though, was that it could have been an employer. Presumably she wasn't a servant for the Harper Caruthers, but we don't know. We just know she was a servant. So we know that the Baptist faith deeply influenced this family and their interactions with the community. And I think it's fascinating to think about how those religious foundations guided them through challenges like the societal implications of a scandal involving Anne having an illegitimate child. Clearly, they're forging a reputation as an upstanding family in the community, training the next generations of shoemakers, serving in the local militia, members of a close-knit congregation. But for our last location, we're going to take a look at the next generation. And we're going to head away from the house for this, which I think is a fitting part of the story.
Okay, great.
So our last location for today, we've come to Ticknor Lodge, which is at the entrance to the Cork estate. Have you been here before?
No.
Okay. It's now actually a lovely holiday cottage. So who knows, you may be here again in the future.
Yeah.
It is actually very lovely. It's got these great big sash windows and it's almost a hexagon, the room here, isn't it?
Yeah.
At one end, painted white. Very nice.
Lovely.
We're going to be talking now about your great-great-great-grandmother, Jane Ratcliffe.
Right.
And her husband, John Banton. So Jane is the eldest daughter, as you remember, of Mary and Joseph. And she married John on the 2nd of August, 1847, at St. Saviour Parish, Fourmark in Derbyshire, which is just a few miles. And at that time, we learn that John's father, George Banton, was a labourer. And then marriage is announced in the Derbyshire Advertiser and Journal. These newspapers are just so amazing, aren't they? So at Fourmark on the 2nd instant by the Reverend W. Haycock, Mr. John Banton of Ingleby, to Jane, eldest daughter of Mr. Joseph Ratcliffe, boot and shoemaker of Ticknor in this county.
Oh, brilliant.
And I wonder if it was a love match. I think it might have been because John's father, George, is a labourer. Her father is a cordwainer.
Mm.
So it's a higher social status.
Right.
So she's chosen somebody who comes from a slightly more lowly background. Perhaps they've met as servants. Who knows?
Uh-huh.
Because we see in subsequent years that she is doing some work for Cork Abbey.
Right.
She's paid for carrying out needlework for them between 1854 and 1872, which is fascinating because it was quite common, actually, in the Victorian period for women to work inside the home, what was known as outwork. So they're bringing work in, like needlework. It's been called the economy of makeshift, you know, an essential part of the way in which women are silently contributing to the income of their families.
Okay.
And she's definitely doing that. Whilst also having 8 children. You come from some big families.
Sounds like it, yeah.
So they were born between 1849 and 1865, and they are Lucy, Marianne, George, Emma, Jane, John, Samuel, and Ebenezer. And they're born all over Derbyshire. So they're here in Ticknor, they're in Melbourne, they're in Woodville, they're in Ingleby, they're in Ashby de la Zouche, in Hartshorn.
And do we know why?
Well, it seems that at this time, John was working as a seasonal labourer.
Oh, right.
And so probably moving where the farm work was.
Yes.
By 1856, September 1856, he's actually listed as a step up from a labourer as a husbandman. A husbandman is the old word for a farmer below the rank of yeoman. So it's someone who held his land in a kind of leasehold tenure. He's kind of average farmer, basically, in a locality. Now it gets confusing because we've got so many Janes. But your 3-times great-grandmother, Jane Ratcliffe, died in 1890. She's 64. She dies here in Ticknor. But a year after Jane dies, and this is why we're here, John, 78 years old, is working as a park lodge keeper here.
In this house?
Ticknor Lodge, at this house.
Oh, wow. Living in this house to be the lodge keeper?
Exactly.
Yeah.
How does it feel to be in
the
this
place? Yes, fabulous. It's so interesting.
And it seems to me another instance of being looked after. So here we've got a position being given to him in his old age.
Old age. And he's a widower
It's something that he can do without having to labour on the land, which in your 70s is going to be maybe a little challenging.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's another instance of
the estate providing for its own.
Yes, it does sound very much like that, doesn't it? That's great. So I had seen a photo of a couple called John and Jane Banton standing outside a white lodge house.
Wow.
But I hadn't actually taken much notice of it because I didn't know what the connection was.
That's amazing.
And of course, you never know if people have actually labelled these photos correctly.
Well, now you know that's Jane, your great-great-great-grandmother.
Yes, yeah.
And John, your great-great-great-grandfather.
That's fantastic. And it would be great to know when it was taken because we actually don't have any photos that go back beyond, say, the 1940s of that branch of the family.
Well, Jane died in 1890, so you've got an end point there.
Yes.
So Ebenezer, his son, continues to live here after he dies in 1902 and marries Sarah Smith on Boxing Day 1911. The couple don't have any children. He continues to work as a blacksmith and is employed by a Savonsey crew of Cork Abbey. He's also in the church choir and he's a bell ringer.
Really?
So he's certainly moved away from the Baptist faith, has joined the Church of England.
Yeah.
And the couple are still here in 1927. So not 100 years ago.
That's amazing, isn't it?
And one thing I'm just so struck by is we've had so many family ties to the estate.
Yes.
We've got Francis Peace, the groom. We've got Joseph Radcliffe in the Derbyshire Yeomanry Cavalry.
Mm.
We've got Jane Banton now, Nee Radcliffe, employed as a seamstress.
Yeah.
And then we've got John Banton, her husband, employed as a lodge keeper.
Yes.
That's four generations that you're directly related to. And there's actually the fifth, Ebenezer, because he carries on as a blacksmith for them. So that's five generations working for the Harper Crew family. You know, it's an incredible family history you've got.
It is, isn't it? It's fascinating. And, just had no idea at all. It could so easily have been lost in the mists of time, this history. And it's really been brought to life now.
How do you feel about the fact that your ancestors shared such a close bond with Cork Abbey?
Yes, it's just completely fascinating. It does show the kind of loyalty and the relationships from those times, because it didn't have to be like that, did it? As far as the big family were concerned, it could have been servants come and servants go. So the fact that they were retained and looked upon and cared for in their old age is really quite amazing.
But I think it says something about the nature of your family as well. Good at their jobs. They, you know, were loyal in their service.
Yes.
They were doing something that was valued and respected and was highly regarded. So I think they probably earned that loyalty.
Definitely, definitely. Very proud of them.
So let's just finish the story. Apart from Ebenezer, the rest of the siblings moved away from Ticknor. And that's normally what happened in Victorian Britain. People moved to towns looking for opportunities. And your great-great-grandmother, Jane Banton, is one of those siblings who moved away.
Yes.
So she married James Kershaw.
A cotton dyer, James, yes.
In Lancashire, and they have the five children. Do you know much about them? Where does the story go from here?
I didn't know the other Kershaws, and in fact, they've been quite difficult to follow. But Herbert Edward was my great-grandfather. He died quite young, so he died just when my dad was a little boy. So they, you know, my dad's generation, they didn't know their grandfather, but they did know their grandmother for quite a number of years. Yeah, so that was the Kershaw side of the family. But as far as we knew, they were all from Manchester. So we didn't know that she had moved in and met James.
Well, now you do.
Yeah.
So that brings us to the end of our little stroll around Ticknor and Cork Abbey and the rich family history of the Peaces and the Radcliffes and the Bantons. As rich, I would like to argue, as the Harper Crews, perhaps not in money, but certainly in substance.
For
sure. Do you make of what you've learned?
I just think it's completely fascinating. I think you've brought it all to life for me and the rest of the family. And it's really been amazing, really eye-opening, very thought-provoking.
Well, that's it for this episode of Step Into the Past. My thanks go to Sandy for being such a fantastic guest. Cork Abbey is cared for by the National Trust and is a really wonderful place to immerse yourself in the past, to step back in time. You can find all the information about this podcast at the website findmypast.co.uk, and you can get started on your own family tree for free. Where will your past take you? I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb. Thank you for listening, and don't forget to hit follow in your podcast app so you'll get each episode arriving in your app whenever one is released. I'll see you next time. If you liked this, Series 2 of Step Into the Past by Find My Past is out now. Search for Step Into the Past on your favourite podcast app. We'll be back next week with a new episode of the National Trust podcast. See you then.